Welcome to For Love and Music with Tara Joseph, as she explores the ever-changing music industry with today's top creatives, artists, and executives. Enjoy these fun and informative conversations with a little bit of love thrown in along the way.
This episode was recorded prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. We hope that you're staying safe and healthy, and now sit back and enjoy the show. Welcome to For Love and Music with me, Tara Joseph. So actually today I'm very happy because I'm lucky enough to be speaking to someone who was instrumental in helping guide me through my early days in the music industry. Not only did he have the patience of a saint and the knowledge of a genius, but with the advice he gave, it came with so much care and thought that it made my journey all the easier and more enjoyable. With a resume the likes of none other and a history at Universal Music UK to rival no other, I'm delighted to introduce to you the fabulous and totally unique Bob Brimpson. Bob, how are you, my friend?
I'm very, very well. Thank you very much.
I'm so happy to be chatting to you.
Well, likewise. I think it's been 17 years.
I think you're about right. Maybe a little bit longer. I remember I was looking after the Appletons when we first met. In the early days, yeah. They just signed to Polydor and you were incredibly helpful.
Wow. You seemed very nice. you asked all the right questions.
Well, I always feel that there's no wrong questions. Do you know what I mean? It's like it's better to have the right answers and to not be too proud to ask than to sit there in total ignorance. And I definitely needed to learn.
A lot of managers are not like that. They try and bluff it. And when things go wrong, you ask sensible questions. I think most of the time you just wanted to know how record companies work. What's the politics? Why do decisions get made like they do? Which is like the clever questions to ask. Where's the power? Who's actually making the decision? It was that stuff. And a lot of managers don't ask you that stuff. They just say, give me more money, or I want to do this, or why are you saying no all the time?
I have learned over the past however many years that even though it is about money, it's really not just about money at all. I think for me, if I worked in that way where it was, I'd probably be richer.
Maybe. Well, maybe, maybe not. I still think it's about understanding some talent and taking some care and trying to help them have a career.
Exactly.
Rather than seemingly make some money quickly and then it's all over. You were interested in careers for people rather than a quick buck. And a lot of managers just want the next lump of commission. That's all they can see. And they make bad decisions because of that.
It's interesting to hear you say that because, yeah, you're right. I have always been about the overall picture rather than just a quick buck. So how did your relationship with Universal Music UK start? How did it all transpire that you ended up? Is it a 17-year career with them?
21,
okay.
Yeah, I was managing Britpop bands that were kind of reasonably successful, but I wasn't really earning a lot of money. And a little label got bought by BMG and folded into Arista. And the guy that ran it said, stop managing bands and come and work for me and just do whatever it is that you do. It's a guy called Martin Heath. And he wanted me to do A&R, be an A&R director. And I hated A&R. I lasted like 3 or 4 weeks before I just decided it was awful. It just wasn't for me. But what I did do, because I was a bit bored, when I was a roadie and a tour manager and a manager, it used to really infuriate me that record companies didn't seem to understand what their contracts actually meant. And if you talk to one lawyer, they'd say one thing, like recoupment or tour support and who paid for what, where lines were. So I decided to write a manual while I was at Arista and just started giving these little kind of fact sheets to people of how things work and what tours are and how you should put them together and contractually what it means, right? Instead of it being like loads of legal speak. Just writing it in plain English. And Universal saw it and said, can you leave Arista, which I was happy to do, because it was an awful label, and say, come and work for us. And they gave me this little job at Mercury Records. Then I started doing more and more of that, and it just snowballed. It absolutely snowballed, because it turned out everybody wanted to just decide what things meant, even the lawyers. So it was just somebody coming along who wasn't a lawyer. This is fair, and this is a reasonable way of interpreting your contract. And it sounds pretty dry, but what it did was it got rid of loads of disputes really quickly. So managers would come in and say, no, you should be paying for that. And the label would say, no, we've done this and this. And all of a sudden, because somebody had written it all down, everybody said, well, let's just go by what this guy said. See what I mean? Then all the labels wanted me to do things like look at all the budgets that came in and decide where they went, whether it was the band paying, whether it was the label paying, what was fair. And then if there was disputes, they'd ask me to go to speak to the manager and find out the real problem was and try and find a compromise. Or there'd be new managers in, like yourself, and they'd say, you haven't done a record deal like this before. Can you go and speak to that manager and see if you can help them through it and make it a smoother process? And that's how it started, really. And it went from nothing to absolutely huge very, very quickly.
Yes, absolutely. And I presume that people are still working by your guidelines currently.
Largely, yeah. Even though I kind of stopped doing that particular thing about 5 years ago. I mean, I would say it completely changed a lot of things, really quite hugely, certainly touring world. Because what it did was it forced managers, like beginner managers or experienced managers, to do it in a very business-like way. Right. So it was harder to defraud bands, for example, and just ask for money and with no accounting and no responsibility. And a lot of money was getting wasted. My father had been signed to Decca.
I didn't know that. I know he was a folk musician. Is that right? Yeah. Legendary folk singer.
He was signed to Decca. And in fact, one of my earliest memories of Dad, and I spent an awful lot of time touring with my dad rather than going to school, was him being dropped by Decca. And how devastated he was. So I was very aware of that, that in the end, it's all about some people who have got like a dream. They want to be a successful musician. They want to be successful. So if you're being paid by a record company, I was always very aware that you have to do your best all the time and you have to make it fair. I wanted to make it harder for bands to be defrauded so that and force managers into doing things in a business way. But it also forced people to ask the right questions. If you were going to go and do an American tour, for example, well, let's work it out properly. Let's look at the routing properly and make sure that it's economical. And then we'll make a decision about whether it's a good business decision for that artist to go to America. So it all became much more easier to decide whether things were a good thing to do.
So, no, I was going to ask. So if there are new artists, new bands, solo artists, whatever, listening to our podcast today, and they're hearing your words of wisdom, what advice would you give to them for things to look out for when they're embarking on their new journey in the music industry?
Yeah, your signature is your most precious possession, right? That's the thing you have to remember if you're a musician. And the people that you put around you, there's kind of five groups of things that you have to have around you. One of them is going to be your accountant. Now, your accountant is somebody that will safeguard you against making sure that if you have a career, you will actually have something left at the end of it and that you'll only pay for what you're supposed to pay for. Be very careful about letting anybody have access to money that you have earned, that it goes into a place that you can control, and that if you have an accountant, he's maybe allowed to spend money for you, but only under certain conditions so that nobody can just come along and empty your bank accounts or anything like that. It's your money. Everybody is earning money from you. So be very careful about that. There should be a huge separation between that, in my opinion, and your manager. Your manager is a separate person who works for you and invoices for their services and for their expenses. And you and your accountant will decide if that's correct and you'll pay them. So if you get those two things right, then I think the rest of it is down to creative decisions and your manager's in the right position to help you make good creative decisions. Your agent is in the right decision to help you make creative decisions. The label, I think, is get those things right. A good accountant and a good lawyer are the two things that should be absolutely, that's the car you're driving. The direction you go in is up to you and your manager. But those things should be, take a long time to make sure that those people are good, honest people with a good track record. It's not worth them ripping you off. They're very experienced in the business and get that right. And then you're fairly secure. That makes sense?
Yeah, no, 100%. I absolutely agree. Would you say since you started out in the industry that it's changed a lot? Changed for the better or for the worse?
I think it's much better for artists at the moment. I think it's a great time to be a new artist at the moment because there's all sorts of new opportunities that weren't there before. It's not as controlled by a small group of people as it used to be. You can't control social media. So if you can't do that, well, so many things happen by word of mouth now. And that's really exciting, I think. I'd say it's a little bit drier and a little bit more sanitized and a little more businesslike than it used to be. And maybe it's not as many laughs as it used to be. But I think it's a good time. I think it went through a really bad era for about a decade. I think the sort of around the turn of the century and to the noughties, it was Napster and Illegal Download was just killing everybody. Those days seem to have gone now. And I think it can be great at the moment.
So with regards to your career, what would you say has been your biggest obstacle to date? And how did you overcome the challenge?
Well, I think the biggest challenge I ever had was being asked, after I was doing all this stuff about contracts and touring and managers and stuff, and they came to me at the end of around the turn, about 2000, and they said they knew that the internet was coming, and they knew that they were going to need a lot more moving image. Videos were costing an extraordinary amount of money. They were made by a very small group of people who seemed to completely have control of it. And various people had come along and tried to find ways of making it more cost-effective, because they knew that unless they found a way of controlling that, it was another thing that was going to kill them. We used to make 100 videos a year at university in the UK. It's nearer 500 now. It's huge. And that's not including content, which runs into the thousands of pieces. We do it a fraction of the cost that we used to do. And I kind of think I played quite a big part in that. But everybody had been told you can't do anything about it. People have tried before and not been able to get anywhere. And I was given sort of complete control over that situation for a while. And I won, I think.
So you really have spent the past 20 odd years overseeing tours, money for tours, videos, as you were just saying. Do you have a preference? Did you enjoy one part more than the other or equally in different ways?
They were very different, but yeah, I mean, the two, it was the biggest video operation in the world and the biggest touring operation in the world, right? And you're doing them both at the same time with two completely different sets of people. And video world, it's a much more kind of, there's some really great creatives in video world. It's a real sort of privilege to work with some of those people that were really the kind of people that could just do anything. They just happen to be video directors. They're just those kind of people that could do. You're one of those kind of people. I'm sure if you decided to open a chain of restaurants, you'd be able to do it. You just want to run an airline. You know, you could probably
do
it.
Kind.
Yeah. But you get that a lot in video world. They're incredibly capable people who can do the impossible in like a really short space of time and make the most incredible things. And that was a real privilege to be around. Touring's a lot more rock and roll still because it's just a longer thing. It's much more of a lifestyle. You're traveling around, having a party every day.
Do you enjoy that?
I did for a time, yeah. I really enjoyed touring, and I think I was a good guitar roadie, which is what I used to.
Yes, I have to ask you about your days as a guitar roadie with Alison Moye, Kirsty MacColl, Terence Trent D'Arby. Go on, spill the beans. What's the hot goss?
You know what? I knew you'd ask me, because people ask you, like, who's your favourite artist you've ever worked for and everything. I never think of it like that. There's lots of people I met in all sorts of disciplines. Some of them are artists, some of them are managers, some of them are video directors, some of them are video producers. But they're all people I really admired, and I'm really glad that I met them. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But it's great to stand on the side of stage when you've got thousands of people having a great time. The band are having a great time. The band are making loads of money. You've done your job properly so that it's all working, right? And nobody's noticed anything. Nothing's gone wrong. That's great. It's a really great feeling. And it's over. That's the great thing. It's no hangover. The band go off stage and go to their dressing room and it's finished. It's not like everything else is sort of like a month later, you're still arguing about invoices and you're arguing with this and you're arguing about that. But touring's great because it's just like, it's like Groundhog Day, but it finishes every day. That's great. It's such a nice feeling. It's like you're free every day. I really enjoyed that.
So tell me, so what do you do if you're working with a really big star or massive band and you're presented with a tour budget where the expenses are off the chart and you're like, okay, well, these people are massive superstars, but what they're trying to spend here or have spent is unacceptable. How do you deal with that kind of situation?
Well, if you've let it go that long, you're in a bad situation. The thing to do is you have to be a few steps ahead of that. Mm-hmm. So if you see it coming, your best friend is the manager, right? Because his fight is your fight. Sorry, her fight is your fight. It's their profit margin at the end of the day. So it's not in their interest to overspend on people. Get great people by all means, but pay them a reasonable rate for what they're doing. And if you can recruit them, I have all sorts of systems and charts and things to say what people should earn in certain situations, what's a reasonable pay for people, whether it's a session musician or a monitor man or a lighting designer or whatever. You can tell them what reasonable rates are and to go out and negotiate rates like that. And the way I control it for the company is to say, if you're within these rates, and I will give them a rate for absolutely everything, great, we'll support it. If you go above that, that's your problem and you can pay for it, right? You'll pay the difference. So it's in their interest to kind of make it go down a little bit. And for the most part, that method works pretty well. I really don't mind going to war with people about, I'll speak to them and tell them that they're charging too much money. And it's like, well, you can have a year's work here if you do us a reasonable deal. But if you don't, then you're probably going to get replaced halfway through, aren't you? I can be quite tough. But again, I
you
go
don't
back-
say. Huh? I said, you don't say.
But you're doing it all for the artist. Money at the end of the day. If you're going to put something on an artist's account, right, if it's going to be something that they are going to have to pay back from their record royalties, you care by them. You're the person between the artist and them being able to buy food one day. And it's like you have a duty of care by that person to make sure that if they spend money, it's spent wisely. It's really easy to say yes and have an easy day. But it's like I'm being paid to be the artist in that situation, to look after the artist's interest. And it's really easy to go to work on that score. I'm not trying to beat somebody up for the sake of it. If they're going to be reasonable with me, I'll be reasonable with them. But if somebody I think is taking advantage, no, I'll go to work.
Yeah. And I love that about you. I love that about you. I love that about you.
Well, I mean, isn't there, there's nothing sadder, is there, though, Tara, than when you see an artist who's had a great career, then you find out that they've had problems with the IRS or they've had problems with this.
100%.
Bad circumstances.
And you unfortunately hear about that quite a lot of the time.
Yeah, and it's happened forever. And it's better than it's been. It's better than it's been for a long time. But and some of the old stories are absolutely tragic. You go right back into the 50s and 60s. I mean, it's just shocking. These people built the industry we work in. And then some of them ended up destitute, living on the streets and stuff. And that's just not right.
No, it's awful. Absolutely awful.
I mean, I took a great deal of, when I was managing, I didn't sell a great deal of records. They're only a footnote in Britpop history, really, but they all did all right out of it. That maybe they didn't thank us for it, but like, I'm pleased that they have somewhere to live at the end of it and they got something out of it. And I think they were.
Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's a point in just being, oh, look at me, I used to be somebody. Isn't it great to be a star?
You want to be able to retire in a bit of comfort if you've worked that hard.
There's nothing sadder than it's like, didn't you used to be so-and-so?
Yes, 100%.
If you're remotely responsible for that, you should be ashamed of yourself.
Yeah.
You have to be out of sleep at night and think that you did the best by your artist. And I can't abide a slacker, either inside the record label or outside the record label.
Yeah.
If I see a charlatan or somebody that's just not taking care of business, that's when you'll see the worst of me.
Yeah. I really trusted back in the day everything you had to say to me, because obviously I'd been agent William Morris representing really successful actors and TV host stroke presenters, and all of a sudden found myself in the music industry with these two big stars at the time, with Nicole and Natalie Appleton, who asked me to manage them because I had been their sort of acting TV agent, and they'd asked me to manage them because they trusted me and they believed that I would fight for them. And knowing, though, that I didn't have a music industry background. And I was like, okay, these girls believe in me. I believe in them. I'm going to give this a go. And it was because of people like you and the support that you gave that made me into the manager that I am today.
You might not have known, you know, knowing how record companies actually work is 5% of it. It's 5% of the job.
Yeah.
You turn up with every skill that you actually needed to manage a band successfully. There was some nuts and bolts stuff you didn't really know, and you didn't really understand that the kind of politics of a record label. Every record company is different anyway. But it was just steering you through it.
But you know what? It was actually in that instance, I remember walking into London Records, I think it was, and in a way I was terrified, but at the same time, ignorance was bliss. Ignorance was bliss, because I went in there, I asked for what I wanted, and I continued to push and push and push and push until I got what I wanted. And then I was introduced to David Joseph, who was MD of Polydor at the time, and got them re-signed there. Literally, it was ignorance was bliss, because I didn't have the sort of, because I didn't have all of the nuts and bolts knowledge that you're talking about. I think I cut some of the middle stuff out and just went for what I needed, and it worked in mine and their favor. Does that make sense?
It does, but I guarantee you, David Joseph would have made the same decision I made, would either just recognise somebody, but, oh, I bet she'd be really good. I know loads of managers who know the record business inside out, who I wouldn't want to manage me if I was an artist. It's really about how you carry yourself. Are you going to do it with care and attention? Are you always going to be on the end of the phone? are you going to be somebody that we can work with, that we can have a proper grown-up discussion with? Well, yeah, and you understand about management. You understood about managing some really big celebrities at the time, weren't they? Bigger, some of them.
Yeah.
And why wouldn't you be any good? And you know what? About 4 days ago, you'll find this interesting.
Right.
I was having this very conversation with a woman that phoned me up. And I was literally, she was asking me some advice because some friends of hers have got all this attention from all sorts of record labels. And I was just saying to her, why don't you do it? Why are you talking to me about what managers you can go to? You've got every skill that you need to do this. I'll tell you the rest of the stuff. They won't find a better manager than you because you've been their friend for like, she'd known the girl in question who was trying to be signed since she was 5. But the connections that she's got in different disciplines inside the music industry, just give her everything she needs to know. So I said, just why don't you do it? Why are you saying management companies should they be going to? Because you think you're being your friend. The best thing you can do is manage them yourself. You'll be fantastic.
Yeah. Well, she's lucky to have you on side as I was. But let me ask you something else. So obviously the podcast is called For Love and Music. So I have to throw a little bit of love in. I've got to ask you a little bit of love. So a question I ask most people on this podcast, and some people go, what does that mean? Is, has love ever guided you to make an unexpected decision in your career?
Well, I did stop. I quit working for Terence Trent D'Arby when I was 29, I think.
Right.
Done 3 years of like 24/7. I mean, he did not let up. But it was that on my first marriage.
And good answer.
And the thing was, I'm on my third marriage now, so that plainly didn't work, did it? You know, but I did make that decision of like, it's Terence or my marriage. I've got to give up.
I understand. I think we all reach a point in our lives where love comes first.
Yeah. But I mean, I do think you pay a price. I think I've paid quite a hefty price for being so 24/7. Like I say, I'm on my third, effectively fourth marriage. And I don't think I would have been if I hadn't been in such a kind of...
What does that mean, your third, effectively fourth?
Well, I was with another lady for a very long time.
Oh, okay, okay.
You know, we weren't married, but we were...
Okay. I'm with you. I'm like, is that a new kind of arrangement? And is there a song that particularly resonates with you romantically?
There is.
Go on then, spill the beans.
I'm a very big fan of an American band, long gone now, called Little Feat.
Okay.
I had a singer called Lowell George, who's my musical hero. My son is actually called Lowell, after Lowell George.
Oh, I always wondered where that name came from. Now I know. Okay.
But Lowell George is my musical hero. And he wrote a song called Long Distance Love, which is a bit country and it's a bit cheesy. But there's a line in it where he goes, I wonder, does she know she hurt me so? And every time I've ever been kicked in the teeth by a woman, I'm right back there. Absolutely right back there.
Oh, Bobski.
And really, honestly, I'm 16 again, just being dumped by like, some girl and heartbroken.
Don't be heartbroken.
Just the way he delivers that line, it's just like, it's too much. Too much.
Well, I'm going to go off and listen to that song now.
Great. Long Distance Love by Lowell George rather than Little Feat. He made some solo albums.
So okay. Yeah, I'm going to go and listen to that. So what's next for Bob?
What's next? Well, I'm still in the middle of a load of... I still sort of oversee video for Universal, and I don't really know. I mean, they might ring me up next week and say, can you go to New Zealand and do this? So, and if I'm...
We want them to say, can you come to LA?
We do, don't they?
That's what we want.
I was
not
actually very
Timbuktu.
Do you know what? I very nearly knocked on your front door today about...
Oh, I would have been so happy.
I was meant to... I could have been in Vancouver.
Oh, my God.
Or Lewis Capaldi. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it just didn't happen right at the last minute. And the other guy went, I was going to fly to Vancouver and then I was going to fly down to see you. And right as a surprise,
so excited.
Knock on your door about 4:45. So should we do that podcast then? That would have been quite good, wouldn't it?
That would have been brilliant. For the listeners tuning in, Bob's in London and I'm in LA. But obviously Bob and I originally knew one another from when I was living in London. But yeah, that would have been the best surprise ever.
That would have been good.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that have been good?
Oh my God, I'd have been so surprised.
No, I'd love to see you. I would love to see you. Soon.
Well, soon, definitely. Well, listen, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it. You're the best. And anyone out there got any questions, send them in and I will send them your way, Bob. You're probably now getting inundated.
I think of myself as a kind of very backroom person who's quite not very well known. I've been deliberately kind of kept in the background by Universal.
Now you're out there through Love and Music. You are now out there.
Right? Oh, God. Okay.
But thank you. And thank you to all today's listeners. Thank you to Bob. Love you loads. And we'll be in touch again soon.
Thank you for listening to For Love and Music with Tara Joseph. For more information, you can check out at For Love and Music Official on Instagram, at For Love and Music Official on Facebook, and also visit www.jamartistgroup.com/podcast.